welcome to the Ubuntu UK podcast. I'm Simon.
I'm Tony.
I'm Davey.
And what's in episode 7?
We're going to hear some interviews from UDS.
We have a discussion on programming with a focus on Python.
And we're going to announce the results of our competition.
Sounds like a fun-packed show.
So Tony and I are now here with the internet's Jono Bacon. We want to talk a bit about FOSCAMP and UDS. So you're partly responsible for organising this whole shebang. Tell us a bit about FOSCAMP.
One of the problems with events is that they're often very much driven by certain vendors, you know. And, you know, you have things like Ubuntu Developer Summits, which are obviously very Ubuntu-focused, and there's things like the Red Hat events, and I think Novell do some stuff. And we just thought it would be really valuable to get loads of different upstreams together in the same physical venue and base it around upstreams. So for people who aren't familiar with distributions, upstreams are just general open-source projects. You know, because there's a lot of value when you get, you know, a bunch of X people together, some Open Office people together, you know, you get some HAL people together, and interesting conversations happen. Yeah, so the last one was the first FOSCAMP, and it was a blast, and this one has been excellent. I mean, I've heard some reports from some of the discussions, and there's been some really valuable discussions happening. So
so it's designed to be kind of Ubuntu agnostic or distro agnostic, at least some degree, but obviously it's tacked onto the front of UDS, which is the Ubuntu Developer Summit, so you're going to have a high concentration of Ubuntu people here, but also developers who know a lot about upstream. Do you get a feeling that we need more upstream, more involvement from other people, more integration with upstream and other distros as well at an event like this?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, I mean, one of the problems that we have is that there's quite a lot of Ubuntu people there, and it's absolutely not an Ubuntu event. You know, if you look at the website, it's got nothing to do with Ubuntu on there. It's not part of Ubuntu.com or anything like that. It's its own independent event that we just wanted to do. Part of the reason why we tack it onto the front of the Ubuntu Developer Summit is so we can send people, because they're going to be in the same location. And also, we sponsor a lot of people for the Ubuntu Developer Summit who are from upstreams. So we think if we sponsor them to come out to UDS, well, then we might as well send them a couple of days earlier and have them come to FOSCAMP, so we can actually pay for people to go to FOSCAMP. But there's people from Red Hat, people from Novell, there was a load of people from Debian. And it's absolutely important to get loads of these different projects together.
How do you think FOSCAMP differs from other events like FOSDEM?
I think what's probably more interesting about FOSCAMP is that it's more contained. Like, if you go to FOSDEM, there's loads and loads of people around, loads of different projects. There's far more open source free software projects around, but it can be difficult to get the right people in the same venue, you know, in the same room talking to each other, because there's just so much going on. There's 10 things going on at any one time. And at FOSCAMP, it's a smaller event, but it's about having that level of diversity, I think, is important. And also the format, the fact that it's an unconference, you know, people can just talk about what they want. You know, we had some really, really good discussions. Unfortunately, I was locked in various sessions. I couldn't attend some sessions I wanted to go to, but everything I saw was excellent.
So when you say it's an unconference, how does the scheduling system work for an unconference?
Well, basically, it's great. It's the lazy person's conference, because what you do is you put up a big empty schedule and then you just get other people to do it for you. So the plan was that, like FooCamp, we have a big empty schedule and we do an intro. I did an intro and said, you know, this is how it works. If you want to talk about something, go and add it to the schedule. And people go in there and they add, and you get some really random stuff. I mean, I went to FooCamp, which kind of pushed this idea, and they had like weird sessions on lockpicking and mind hacking and all kinds of stuff. And it's much more focused on this, but it's you get that kind of level of diversity in terms of sessions, and it's great, you know. So this means that we don't define the schedule. People who are at the event talk about what they think is interesting and important.
You don't really know what's going to get discussed until you get here, really, do you?
Oh yeah, I mean, we could have some complete crack, and we absolutely, you know, actively encourage it, you know. You know, you might have someone say, yeah, I've got a session, it's going to be called, you know, rewrite the Linux kernel in, you know, Haskell or something. And people sit down and have some really mad discussions. Guarantee you any unconference, you'll see sessions you think, I'm going to have to go to that because it's just going to be a freak show in terms of what they're talking about.
But is there useful stuff that comes out of it as well?
There's a risk that with these kinds of events that you just get people talking about a load of nonsense that's not actually useful. I've been to a few conferences where that's happened.
But there's part of this building relationships. It's not just necessarily just about let's have a discussion about X or Y. It's building relationships between upstream and Ubuntu, and also between various upstream projects, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's it. I mean, I think some of the best ideas in the world that have happened everywhere have been scrawled in the back of a fag packet, you know, and a cigarette packet for our non-English people, and, you know, or on the back of a beer mat or something. They happen in pubs, they happen in corridors, they happen in people's front rooms. some of the most valuable discussions that happen at a UDS or at a FOSCAMP or anything will happen in a corridor. So it's getting people in the same vicinity. And that's one thing I was really pleased with this FOSCAMP was the fact that we had, you know, 30 or 40 different projects represented here and loads of people who probably never meet in other circumstances together. Because you get, like with most free software projects, you get the same kind of group of people going to conferences. There's this very definitive set of people who always attend conferences. And you see them all the time if you do the conference circuit. So it's nice to kind of get other people there. And that's one of the things, particularly tacking on the front of UDS, it means that when we invite people to UDS, it means that we can think also who we invite into FOSCAMP and deliberately pick people who aren't typically on that group of people who come along to these conferences all the time.
So you mentioned UDS, which follows straight on from FOSCAMP. What's the purpose of UDS in a nutshell?
The idea is that we sit down, we discuss things, propose features, propose things that we want to do in Ubuntu or propose changes to the community. At the end of each session, we have a set of action points that we can actually engage with. UDS is something that's really, I think this is my third one. I've been to, let me think, Mountain View, Seville, Boston. This is my fourth one. And it develops every time. We try and fix different things and try and refine it in different ways every time. And this is by far, from what I can tell, the smoothest so far.
Is it a case that Canonical come with a list of things that they would like to see in the next release and community members then try and chip in a few extra things? Or does the vast majority of stuff come from the community?
Well, traditionally what we did is we had a system whereby people could register specifications on Launchpad, and then those specifications could be proposed for discussion at a UDS. This particular one's a little different in the fact that the people who lead the tracks have gone and looked at the issues that are pertinent in their particular parts of the community, so things that there's been a lot of discussion about, things that they think need to be fixed in Ubuntu. It really is very representative of the community. The other thing is that we've deliberately left slots blank, so when we get here, we fill them. I mean, already today, I've had two slots filled with community sessions.
What about the social side of UDS? You're getting a lot of people together who, you know, don't normally meet in real life from all over the world, and do you have any kind of, like, social things arranged as well?
Yeah, I mean, the social thing is a very important part of a UDS, because one thing that we've learned in Canonical is, you know, the whole company is distributed. We have people from all over the world, and if you don't get people together a certain amount of time every year, they lose these social bonds that they have with each other. And luckily in the, you know, for the Ubuntu project, you know, we have, you know, a bunch of people meet up at least once every 6 months. And part of UDS is getting people to have fun with each other, you know, so people enjoy themselves and have a good time as well as being productive. For example, when we pick a venue, we deliberately pick a venue that's got a fairly social area where people can mingle and people can sit down, they can plug in laptops and they can code together and things like that, which is part of it. But also evening events. I mean, typically at UDS in the past, we just basically, as soon as the day was finished, people were left to their own devices. And this time we've tried to pick places where we've talked to the local loco team, and they've advised venues where we can recommend people to meet up in the evening. So if people don't know where to go, they can go there. And then we've also got this jam night on the Friday night, Ubuntu All-Stars, where we've hired a venue and got a load of musical instruments, and we're going to play some music. And
not death metal, though?
Unfortunately not. I mean, much as I'd like to have, you know, some Cannibal Corpse being played, it probably might not go down too well with the rest of the crowd. So,
given the T-shirts that most people are wearing here, I think it'll probably go down quite well with, with most of them. They do look like metalheads, most of them. I don't know what that is.
Well, I think this should be encouraged, you know?
Once UDS is over, there's going to be a lot of stuff that's been discussed and specifications that have been written. Where can people in the community find out about what was discussed? Because obviously they can get involved during the week, but once the week is over, you know, they might want to find out what's been happening, what's been going on. Where can they find out more information?
Well, right now what we're doing as UDS continues, we're asking each of the people who run the sessions to kind of make a log of what they've discussed in the session and add that to this report page. And then I'm planning on taking all of this content and sort of merging it together into something that's more readable. So there will be a UDS report that will be released to the community afterwards. But in the interim, if people go to wiki.ubuntu.com/UDS-intrepid, you can see there's a link on there to the report, and they can see all of the reports from all of the sessions on the different tracks there. And then obviously as time goes on, you know, the best place to find out about Ubuntu development is the planet Ubuntu.
Thanks very much for joining us, Johnny. Cheers.
Competition results.
Okay, the question we set last episode was, what is the name of the Windows installer for Ubuntu that was first released in Ubuntu Hardy? And we had a lot of correct answers. In fact, we didn't have any wrong answers for this one. And the answer was...
Wubi.
Excellent. Now, who won?
Ben Thorpe.
Congratulations, Ben, and we'll email you the details of the voucher.
Good on you. We've also got an interview coming up from the Wubi guy himself.
And we'll have another competition in the next episode.
Possibly a bit harder this time.
Tony and I are here with someone who's commonly known as the Wubi guy. Tell us who you really are and why you got that name.
Hi, I'm Ago. I'm basically one of the developers and, in fact, one of the authors of Wubi, which is this new installer that ships now with Ubuntu.
This allows people to install from within Windows. It's a Windows application, isn't it?
Absolutely. Basically, the idea is to be able to install Ubuntu as if it was a Windows application. So any user that can install a Windows application can now as easily install Ubuntu. And in fact, if for any reason they do not like it, they can even uninstall it as a Windows application. So it doesn't require any extra knowledge or any particular experience. It's probably one of the easiest way to install an operating system, whether Linux, Windows, whatever.
It's a kind of mix, isn't it? It's a Windows application and there's some stuff going on within Ubuntu as well.
Okay, there are two pieces. One is the Windows side, which is basically like a wizard, a typical application wizard. It's a very simplified interface. So normally user only have to put their name and password for the new account and click install. The trick is to make Linux think that the file works as an hard disk. Wubi is not a virtual machine, so the installation you get is exactly identical to a dual boot installation, except for their disk, whereby their disk is not a real partition or hard disk, but it is a file which is seen by Linux as an hard disk.
This is ideal for someone who wants to try out Ubuntu. They've maybe not tried it before, but they don't want to make any changes to the partitioning on their Windows disk.
That's absolutely correct. Basically, Wubi doesn't make any change whatsoever to the Windows system. It doesn't change the bootloader, so you keep the same bootloader you have. We simply add an entry to your existing bootloaders. It is exactly like a normal application. So it just simply puts a folder on your file system.
So you can just delete that folder and you've deleted the application, or you've deleted Ubuntu.
Exactly. So in fact, if you go, it's even easier, if you go into the control panel, add remove programs, you will see Ubuntu, click on it, it's gone. It's like the system is exactly like it was before you installed it.
It's always been a big disadvantage for Linux that at some point in the installation process, you have to answer questions about partitioning. And there's a whole kind of terminology around partitioning that Wubi gets around by just having this thing on the disk. What sort of questions do they have to answer to get it installed?
Username and password. The username, in fact, is already prefetched from whatever is the Windows username. So it's just the password and click install. I wanted to add, it's not just the partitioning we go around to. We also avoid people, spare people troubles with burning a CD. With Wubi, there is no reason to burn a CD. You simply download the executable, like a normal application. It's an .exe file. You run it, and the .exe will download the appropriate files for you. It is, in fact, the standard ISO file. In fact, it has a fairly good download. It will do things that people normally do not do, such as checking the consistency of the file. So we are sure that the download is correct, is what it's supposed to be, it hasn't been tampered with. Partition is one of the aspects, and we have also the CD burning. So basically another obstacle where people sometimes stumble.
Whilst you say the only information that the user has to type in is their password, there are other options, but they're all pre-filled. Can you tell us what some of those other options are?
Yeah, they are basically, of course, you know, there are things that people usually ask. I try to keep the interface to the bare minimum, to make it as simple as possible. But of course, there are things that people do want to change, and so we make it possible for them to change them if they want. They're already pre-filled, so there's no need to change them, but if they want to do so. The fields in particular are the disk where you want to install Ubuntu. That's basically where the virtual disk is going to be. So it's not that the disk is going to be erased or anything. You know, it will take some space off the disk, of course. How much space you allocate to Ubuntu. First thing, it allows you to choose the flavor of Ubuntu. And then the other option that the user can select is the language of the installation. So if they want, the language is already pre-selected to the language that the user is actually in when they run Windows. But of course, they might want to have a different language. And on top of that, we have an accessibility page. So that basically for anyone that may need that, they may set up the appropriate option and it will be available once you boot into Ubuntu.
And what happens there? You've got your image on disk, and it does what to put Ubuntu in that image? What does it do?
Yeah, basically the way it works is that after you only have to press install, so that's all the user has to do. Put the password, press install. That's it from the user side. So it doesn't get any simpler than that, I think. From a more technical point of view, what happens is then you get a download. We prefetch all information from the machine, so it's a running system, which helps us a lot. We know what keyboard you layout you're using, what language you're in, the time zone, etc. So there are lots of questions that an installer has to ask, we don't ask, because we know what they are. So we prepare this information for an automated install once you are in Linux, so it's called a preceding. We install group for DOS, which is basically a great bootloader that allows you to boot into Windows. We don't replace the Windows bootloader. This is simply a chain loader. So basically the Windows bootloader will load group for DOS, which in turn will load Linux. And then we create these virtual disk files, which are just files on a Windows file system. At this point you reboot, and we have some special modification to Ubuntu, so that Ubuntu will look for the ISO file on disk, and will find the precede file which we prepared on the Windows side, and we start the automatic installation via Ubiquiti, targeting the virtual disk we have prepared before. So instead of doing a partition or anything, we'll simply format the virtual disk, which is a file. Basically, what happens is that once you finish the Windows side installation, you will be asked to reboot. When you reboot, you will see two options, so it's still the Windows bootloader screen, but you will see Windows. Second option will be Ubuntu. So you click on Ubuntu, and then everything else is automatic. You will see a scroll bar for until the installation completes. This is the Linux side installation, the real installation, in fact. And once that is done, it reboots again. And from now on, every time you click Ubuntu, you are into Ubuntu.
But because it's a real install, you get full access to the hardware, everything works, the graphics acceleration works, everything like that?
Absolutely. Basically, you have the full glory of a complete desktop. Sound card is the same, every device is accessed natively. Of course, being inside another file system creates some input-output latency. So there is a bit more overhead when you read and write to disk. It's not massive in the sense that a normal user will not notice much difference in practice.
Have you thought about having a system where they could switch? I mean, could they then switch from having Ubuntu in a file to having it take over the whole disk, you know, become the first class citizen on the machine?
Yeah, we already have a couple of scripts working, so it's certainly something on the table. The advantage being that there will be no input-output latency, so the disk access will be faster. You will be able to hibernate, because at the moment with Ubi you cannot hibernate. And the further advantage is, of course, being a file inside another file system, which is in this case NTFS or VFAT. You are subject to all the problems that you might experience in the host file system. So, for instance, if NTFS is very fragmented, your performance will suffer, which is something unnecessary, because Linux file systems do not get fragmented to begin with.
Have you thought about or discussed the ability to have exactly the same thing, but for Mac users, so they could have Ubuntu in a file on their Mac file system?
Yeah, in fact, we have the plan was to create three projects. One is called Ruby, of course. Another one was called Luby, which is the Linux version. So if you have another Linux, you can install Ubuntu if you want into a loop file, same thing, without changing the partition. Maybe you're out of partitions, whatever. For any reason, you want to try Ubuntu that way, you can do it. And the third option, in fact, Luby is already available as an individual application. Slightly different interface, but it's more or less the same thing. The backend is always the same. And the third application is intended to be Mubi, which is the Mac version of Ubi. And we haven't started development yet, to be honest, but we'll be looking into that as well.
Excellent. And presumably there's a website where people can take a look and find out more?
Yes, it's vubi.installer.org. On top of that, Vubi is also available on the CD. So if you hop in the CD of the live CD of Ubuntu, you will see there is a small application which is called Umenu, which is something I also wrote. And that basically gives the second option is install inside Windows, which will in turn launch Vubi. So that's also a possibility.
Yeah. Thank you for talking to us.
You're very welcome.
So one thing we've been talking about is programming in Python. And we thought it's been an interesting discussion to have.
Computing is essentially a hobby for me. It's not work. I don't work specifically in IT, although, of course, I use computers. Why Python? Why did I want to learn? I want to give something back to the community. And essentially, there's loads and loads of things that go on. People saying about how you can add to the community, working with bugs. You know, there's the 5-a-day thing. Looked at that. Not a chance. Just really, that's just far too difficult. Documentation. Yeah, that's another one I could add to. I can write, I can type, but I just fancied getting into programming. Well, most people would buy a book or find a website. So I bought a book, which was one of the O'Reilly ones, and that is
O'Reilly.
which is great, but it's a book. I don't learn particularly well from books because you teach yourself.
I find that with programming books, when I've looked at them, there are obviously examples and things to work your way through. And if they work, you don't always understand why they work because you've just followed what's on the book. And if they don't work, you've got no idea how to fix it because the book doesn't expect it to break. And so although you can stumble through examples from books, I find I don't often get a huge amount of understanding about what actually the language is doing underneath, apart from for the very simple examples.
See, now, I entirely agree with you, and this is something which I've said before, and a lot of people I know don't agree with me in the community. I mean, if you want to write a script that just literally says hello world to the screen, then you can get that from a book or from a web page. If you want to do one that basically does a simple menu, maybe, you know, this sort of shop things where you want to buy this, buy that, and then it tells you what you've bought, adds it up. If simple things like that, then yeah, you can pick that up on your own. But when you start getting onto things like technical things like object orientation programming and other concepts like that, I really don't think I could have learned that without being formally taught. That's not something I could have learned from a book. It's not something I could have learned from a web page. It's something I need to actually be shown and talked through.
One of the things I find with sort of learning languages, and I've started to learn Python in the past, and I'm trying to learn Ruby as well, is it's very easy to get, you know, the very simple examples working. As soon as you try to do something like PyGTK and look at GUIs on applications, it suddenly gets a lot more complex, and you've got the whole object-oriented paradigm, which doesn't really seem to fit in my head somehow. I'm fine with procedural stuff, and that's probably why I get on with shell scripting and things, which I do for system administration. But object-oriented stuff doesn't seem to kind of click with me, and I just get lost. I'd love to be able to, you know, hack up an application and stick an extra button in or tweak it in some way that it needs to be able to do. But it seems so overwhelming.
I know I certainly learned with myself doing monolithic, where it just goes from start to finish, as you would with a shell program. But I did do that at home in front of a book, copying examples, you know, from magazines and things. I mean, I think when it really gets technical, as I keep saying, I think you really do need someone to actually say, do this, do this.
One of the things that I find when I'm learning a language or I've tried to learn a language is that once you get past the basic structure of this is an array or whatever, this is a function, this is how you call a function, this is how you add two numbers together. It's just a case of learning all of the different functions or the ones you're most likely to use. And in some respects, once you've got the basic functions of the language and you've got the basic structures of how the syntax works, that's all you should need to know. But there seems to be so many kind of little quirks and differences and things about how different languages work and little bits of syntax that you keep tripping up on that it's quite overwhelming and intimidating. I don't think I could chop between languages very easily. I know when I haven't been doing some bash scripting or something for a while and then I go back to it, I have to remind myself of all the different bits of syntax that are different from PHP, for example. And they're not two hugely different languages either. I don't quite see how those sort of skills are transferable between different languages as much.
Well, I certainly see what you're saying. I mean, I used to program in Java and C++ professionally, and on one week I'll be working on one language, on the next week I'll be working on the next. And I must say, I did actually find that I did try and use syntax or functions from the other language that I would expect to be there.
I did some Open University stuff a while back, and I did a bit of programming on that, and I really struggled with it. And when Ian came along and did the interview with us, how long ago now? A few podcasts ago, Oswald from Show Me Do. I didn't realize that they had a beginner's Python set. So I went along and I've downloaded a stack of the videos and I'm working through them. And it's working. I'm referring to the books and I'm working through the beginner's Python series. Now, you know, to show me Doer doing it in an interesting way. You basically leap on in there. I'm not learning about the technical names about things. I'm just literally doing it. I'm jumping in there with an editor and writing Python, and it works. And we're selecting stuff from menus and working with comma separated value files at the moment, but it just works.
So what does a screencast on Python actually have? What is it, a terminal window, and you just see the characters they're entering?
No, you've got a screenshot. Essentially, they've recorded the editor, the Python editor, and he talks through what's been done, what's written, what it does, how it works, where it can fail, and that's it. And all you see is on the actual video is the Python editor, and you can refer to the website where all the stuff is discussed in more detail if you need to.
And is there actually a copy and paste from there as well, or is that just a case of literally copying what you see on the screen?
There's no facility to copy from the video, and that's actually a good thing, because if you copy and paste then you don't learn anything. So you've literally got to type everything. So, you know, that's the best way to do it. And of course, with modern editors, they will use colours and things to show you if the program is correct or if it's wrong, and what it is that you're actually typing.
You've obviously got a voiceover and you've got the terminal stuff going on the screen. How is it different? Why has that been successful for you, whereas looking at a book hasn't been?
I suppose it's because I'm listening to somebody speak and I'm seeing what they're doing, and I can play the video back and listen to it again and again and again, which I've done certainly on one particular video. You can also get feedback on the website. So if it doesn't work, you can, and it's not just the guys that are writing the videos, it's everybody else that's following the Python series. If you drop your question into that particular video, then everybody will leap in and answer your question and help.
Does that tally with your experiences of kind of more formal training, Dave?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, maybe it's just ways of learning, but I know very, very few people who've actually just sat down in front of a book and actually taught themselves. I think it is about having someone over your shoulder telling you.
You've got to have something to drive you to do these things. What the hell is the point in using Python or learning Python if I'm not involved in the IT industry and I'm just, you know, using it as a hobby?
So have you got projects that you'd want to work on?
Yeah, I've definitely identified one already. It's called Pi Trainer, which is, I've got a GPS watch heart rate monitor, which I use when I'm running. You know, supported within Windows, as you would expect, but under Linux, there is there's a couple of programs, but there's one which is written in Python. It doesn't do things which I'd like it to do. So now I'm learning Python with a view to hopefully at some stage being able to add to the program.
I've always got a project in mind when I want to start learning language and things. I learned PHP and what have you. And I always find it very frustrating to go through the learning process because you're not actually working on the project you want to work on. So you're working on the shopping cart or whatever it is that the demonstration includes or the books include. And I think, well, I've got no interest in writing a shopping cart. And there are hundreds of shopping carts out there. I'll just use one of those. I want to write something that, as far as I know, nobody else has worked on, and I've got this little itch I want to scratch and get on with it. And it's incredibly frustrating when you don't feel you're producing worthwhile stuff and you're just almost kind of wasting your time, to me. Although, particularly if you're having difficulty picking up the language and you're finding it hard, which I probably did. Do you see the work that you're doing on the videos applying to what you want to do in the long term?
Yeah, and the great thing about it is, it's probably in my head, is the fact that because there's a voice there rather than a book, although I've only briefly met Ian, it's almost, you know, there's a bit of community there to support. And with, as I said, with every video, there's a community there to help and join in and sort of, you know, G you up if things aren't going as well as you want to. Personally, I'm goal focused. So if I want to work on Pi Trainer, then I've got to go through the process to get there. And it's going to be fun learning, I hope. I'm sure I'm going to get into some rough spots, but then I've got you guys to take the mickey when I'm struggling, so that's fine.
I thought you were going to say we might actually help you, but then obviously not.
I'd love to hear of other people's experiences, not just of programming Python, but of learning how they've done it, whether it was hard, and what worked for them.
Cool, so send those into podcast@ubuntu-uk.org.
So I'm here with Tony and Corey from the Ubuntu Studio team. How did you get into Ubuntu to start with?
I was on a popular metal forum. I'm a metalhead guy, metal music, and I had stopped using or dabbling in Linux for quite a while. And right before Wardy launched, someone on this forum said, "Hey, you should try this new distro, Ubuntu." It sounded a funny name. I was kind of skeptical. Oh, it has a brown theme. That's gross. But I tried it out, and it was great. Everything worked out of the box. I got, you know, hooked right back into Linux right with Wardy, and then from then on out, I've been using it pretty much as my primary desktop ever since.
Then you started moving into more the development side of things. How did that start?
Well, since I'm very much into music and things like that, I went to audio engineering school, and I was used to using like Pro Tools and usually Apple solutions. So with me getting into Linux, I was wondering what's out there for, you know, audio applications for editing things. Found this distro called Demuti, and it was funded through a little project that had lost its funding, stopped, and I was wondering, well, I wonder what I can do with Ubuntu. I found another person on the Ubuntu forums that was also of the same mind. He was using the audio distro called Demuti, and we figured, well, maybe we can do this with Ubuntu. He had a wiki written up on how to edit things to suit, you know, working with Ubuntu, and it wasn't quite enough. It was quite a lot to sort through. It was a lot of work to do. So we figured, well, maybe we can try to package a solution for people. They can just install it and it'll just kind of work out of the box like normal Ubuntu.
So his wiki page was kind of going through packages that weren't set up very easily or weren't easy for a user to get going.
Exactly. Just, you know, compiling your own real-time kernel or opening up certain permissions for users to use FireWire devices, certain settings that lent themselves to getting low latency timings for recording, you know, recording audio through your sound card and stuff like that.
And you've had how many releases now?
Hardy is our third. We started with Feisty.
So is it just audio applications or does it do video and stuff as well?
No, that's initially why we got into it, but just focusing on audio, we kind of thought was easy to do just out of the box. We could do audio, and we wanted to separate ourselves a little from what was out there. Most of the distros at the time were just doing audio, and we figured, well, you know, we're not going to constrain ourselves to a CD size. We're going to go with a DVD. We knew that. So why not try to package stuff for doing video editing and 2D and 3D graphic work and things like that.
So what is it that you package for video editing? Because there's quite a few video editors on Linux, and some of them get a bit of stick sometimes.
Yeah, that's probably the weakest area that's out there right now. There are a couple solutions that are good for basic things. I mean, there's always like Kino, which a lot of people use for pulling in and editing a little bit of DV video off cameras. There's a GStreamer solution, PityV, which is coming along pretty well. I like it, but, you know, then again, it's still pretty early in its development. There's also, and I hope I say it right, KDN Live, I guess is okay, but probably is still in the same immature state as PityV. The big standout that we have is Cinelera, or Cinelera. I'm not exactly sure how to say it.
Cinelera.
Cinelera. Everybody tells me something different. But in any case, you know, everybody wonders why it hasn't been packaged up for any distros. And it's a kind of monolithic package. It's a really lot of stuff to, it's a lot of stuff to deal with. It has a lot of its own dependencies, its packaging with it. And when we present this kind of stuff to archive admins, they're like, no, this is just, it's just too much. Along with building it and just how crazy a package it is, it's got some license issues where they're using things like the MST core fonts, which you can't package with things. You can't redistribute. You need it to build the app. The other issue is we looked through a lot of the files and noticed that there's files that just aren't licensed. And we would show these to archive admins, and they're like, we're not going to touch it. So there is currently a complete rework going on of the CV branch of it, and now it's called Luminera. And that's a from the ground up rework. And we're really keen on what they're doing. We're watching them a lot. We have some contact with those guys. Most of the guys that are on my team are watching their mailing list, and you know we're very keen to see what they're going to do. As far as the licensing stuff, from what we see, they're making sure that's all sorted from the beginning. I guess the most help I think we're going to be able to give them is just to package it. Like, as soon as they have something that's workable and we can package, we're going to get it right into Debian, hopefully, as soon as we can.
So that covers a lot of the video type stuff. How about the audio editors? What are the key, you know, really cool audio apps that, you know, you would use or you would recommend other people try?
I kind of think those have been stable for a while. You know, on a basic level, there's always Audacity. Everybody uses Audacity, you know, even on Mac and Windows. Lots of people love that for basic stuff. And then there's Ardour, which is basically our Pro Tools and just, you know, are the king there. Aside from that, there are lots of synths and there's notation software.
One of the things that stands out about Ubuntu Studio is the striking theme. The website looks really cool and looks really, well designed, and it looks really modern. The theme that you have on the desktop is really very cool. It's a kind of dark theme. Is that something personally you find attractive, the dark kind of themes? Is that something that comes from your metal background or what?
Well, yeah, personally it's appealing, but the whole reason behind it was a lot of the professional multimedia applications, you know, have a dark color to it, or all dark themed like that. And that's was really the only reason why we chose to go with a dark theme. Like, if you look at Ardour, like, that out of the box is a darker theme, and there are lots of applications on Windows and Mac that go the same way. Like Avid products, for example, are like that. And that was really the only reason why we did it. A lot of people that do GTK applications, they always think of black text, you know, black text and, you know, a background that will work with that color text. Where when you have a dark theme, typically you're going to try to go with white text. And if an app creator is, say, hard coding a background to be white, and then they're pulling the text color from the GTK RC, if we're setting white text, you're not going to see anything there.
Are there certain applications that you have issues with on Ubuntu Studio? I know Mozilla has a toolbar across the top that's one color. Are there any others that kind of stand out that kind of jar slightly when you're looking at them like that?
For the most part, we've reduced really what a user is going to see, because we set the text to a light gray. But if we had our way and we could set it to white, two of the applications that stand out right away are VLC, and when you go into the preferences of Firefox.
Yeah.
Firefox, there's certain icons across the top, and the text that describes what those sections are and what the icon is, they go away.
So what's coming next for Ubuntu Studio? Are there any particular applications you're looking for, or is it just a case of maintaining and putting in the latest versions?
Well, as far as what's next, nothing major, because most of what we do is we try to take the best of what's out there and use Ubuntu Studio, and I guess more like the Ubuntu name, to promote, you know, what we're doing. It's like a showcase. You know, this is the best of what's out there. You know, you really can do a lot with what's going on in Linux. So we'll continue to track what certain applications are doing and what's new, what's coming out, and get those packaged and try to get them into Ubuntu and Ubuntu Studio. Hopefully Debian. We do try to focus on Debian first. If we can get it in there, it goes in there, and then trickles on down to Ubuntu. But aside from that, really just refining our own processes, squashing bugs, making sure the real-time kernel we do is up to snuff and working correctly. Basically, just that.
You said you have a DVD that people could download, so if they want to install it from scratch, they can do. And you also talked about packaging everything so that it's in Debian, in Ubuntu, and it's in the repositories. Does that mean that someone could take a stock install of, for example, Ubuntu, if they've got a live CD and they install it, could they then install some packages that would give them the similar or same functionality without having to download the DVD?
Yeah, you can take a regular stock Ubuntu install. You can install the RT kernel, and then if you search Ubuntu Studio in Synaptic, you'll get a whole list of our packages, or our meta packages that pull in categories of multimedia applications, whether it's video work or 3D work or audio work. You can do that, and then you can, obviously everybody likes a theme, you can get the theme.
And while we're at UDS, is there anyone you particularly want to talk to, or is there any talks or sessions that you particularly want to go to?
Well, from a studio point of view, we have most things handled, so there's not like very in-depth talks I need to get with anybody. Most of what I need to do is just thank a lot of people, because really, you know, like I said earlier, this is a project just born from a couple people on the forums. You know, we we got into the developer community. Everybody's been very open, and I'm very humble about it. Just so I thank those people. And aside from that, like personally, I've gotten more into the Ubuntu itself side of the artwork and stuff like that. So I'll be sitting in on anything to do with the artwork and maybe desktop issues and stuff.
So what's the website?
www.ubuntustudio.org.
Great. Thanks for talking to us, Corey.
So I think that brings us to the end. So if you have any suggestions for any future shows, if you have any recorded material, tips, reviews, or even rants, email at podcast@ubuntu-uk.org.
We've also got a group on Facebook. Search for Ubuntu UK Podcast in the group section and you'll find us.
You can also find us on Twitter, twitter.com/UUPC.
And we also have voicemail, which you can get us on international +44 0845 508 1986.
And of course IRC on the Freenode network #ubuntu-uk.
So thank you to our mirrors who help actually serve our show.
Yep, and it just remains for us to say thank you to our guests, and we'll see you next time. Bye bye.
See ya.
Bye.